From all corners of the globe to your ears, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys. Sometimes informative, sometimes controversial, but always unpredictable, it's the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast with your hosts, Hunter, John, and Stu. And now, on with the show.
Hello everybody, welcome to the Midnight Movie Cowboys for this week. Finally got us all back after nearly a month away from the three of us being together, so it's good to be back in that circle. Got my main man, Hunter, over in Dallas. What's going on, mate?
Hello, how's it going?
Well, I asked you that question first, so you've answered my question with a question.
I'm doing quite well,
That is nice to know. Yeah.
Nothing interesting to report.
No? Okay. Then we got Captain Flowhive over in Colorado. How you going, John?
Good. Very good. John. I got some whiskey, lemon juice, and honey kind of helping me ride through this show.
What brand of whiskey are you going to plug in, by the way? What brand of whiskey
is it? It's Evan Williams 7. I think it's got a year on it, like 1762. Not that it was actually bottled back then.
I was going to say, shit, it's not bad to...
I'd be really flying high.
So John, but you're talking about the Flowhive.
Yeah.
Right, so you're in Colorado, right?
Right.
And there's been a lot of talk about bees dying. Is it the weed that's killing the bees, the burning weed?
I would doubt that. We're actually one of the better states for beekeeping.
Okay. Yeah. So it's not the potheads?
No.
Damn it, I have to rethink my old school right wing view on things. Okay.
All right. I think a lot of them have to in this state. It's like you really need to reconsider that whole reefer madness attitude.
Goddamn potheads.
I actually learned on a podcast I've been listening to recently called The Rialto Report, which is very, very good, by the way. The biggest grower of marijuana in Colorado is ex adult film star Hypatia Lee, if you remember her at all or know of her.
I have never heard of her.
Okay. Well.
Know of her, but never seen her work, so.
Yeah, okay. Well, yeah, she's one of the biggest growers of it for a company called Marisol. Does that ring a bell with you, John?
I think I've heard that name floated around. I don't partake of that.
Yeah, I know you don't, but you live there, so I didn't know if you can find it on supermarket shelves. Yeah.
Only reading newspapers or what. No, they're not in regular stores. You have to go to a weed shop, which has to be in certain areas, and they're everywhere. They're not hard to find. But you're going to find them closer to a pawn shop than to a grocery store.
Oh, really? Okay. All right.
Yeah.
All right. Cool. Anyway, this week we're going to carry on with the horror theme being October. And, of course, going to do it in our way, where it's going to be off-kilter from the usual, Halloween and Friday the 13th and Texas Chainsaw Massacres and whatever the fuck you want to, class as horror films, even though they're very good horror films, but we're going to do it in our style,
of
course.
You mean what everybody else is covering? You mean what?
I was trying to be polite about it, but what everybody else is fucking covering, right. Yeah, pretty much, yeah. Anyway, this episode was suggested by Hunter for this week, and it is the Nosferatu original from 1922 and the remake, I guess you can call it, from 1979.
Yeah,
and, what led you? Herzog. Yeah, that's right. What led you to go with this?
I've been sort of on a Murnau kick lately, and I've watched Nosferatu many, many times over the years, but, I hadn't seen a lot of his other films, and I've been watching some of them, and I'd seen the Werner Herzog remake back in college.
Okay.
I went back and watched it recently and was sort of enamored with it after seeing the Murnau one again, and, I went back and watched... Shadow of the Vampire again, and a bunch of these. I've been sort of obsessing over that movie lately, so I thought it would be kind of cool to talk about. Because even though it's one of the most famous horror movies of all time, and its effects have been felt throughout movies, it doesn't get talked about a lot, especially the Herzog remake doesn't get talked about a lot. When people talk about Herzog and Klaus Kinski, they typically talk about Fitzcarraldo, Aguirre, stuff like that.
Yeah, yeah.
They don't talk about Wojciech, but Wojciech's really boring.
Yeah, it is.
but it's one that kind of gets ignored because it's a remake. But it's I think it's a very good one. But um, But yeah, so what are your guys' relationship like with Nosferatu? Because we don't talk a lot about silent movies on this show.
No, so. Which I was going to say, which led me to think about when we first started this in the BJ era, the BJG era.
Before John, not Blowjob.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's, you know.
Back when this was the podcast purely about blowjobs.
Exactly, that's right.
Blowjobs!
Hey!
Swallowing the goo!
Yeah. We did have a tag at the top of the website which said, oh, talk about silent films. And I was like, well, we never talked about a freaking silent film in our life until now. So
we just, like, mentioned them in passing, but...
yeah.
But, you know, I I've been watching a lot of silent movies lately. And, you know, being on a Murnau kick, I think anything he did in sound is mostly lost. Like, he did a sound version of stuff like City Girl, but if you, you know, I don't think it's available anywhere. Silent versions was available.
Did you ever see one of his called Sunrise? Is that his?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Love Sunrise, yeah.
Okay. Yeah. I know of it, but yeah, I've not seen that.
He made Faust in Germany, and Sunrise was his first movie for Hollywood.
Okay.
And he made several movies in Hollywood, and then he did Taboo independently before he was killed in a car wreck.
Who did M?
That was Fritz Lang.
Okay, yeah, okay. Wrong German.
What's funny about M is that, because I've also been watching a lot of Fritz Lang lately, and the Dr. Mabuza movies, you know, spies,
God, they're boring as all heck.
I love them.
I watched, is it Dr. Mabuse the Gambler?
Yeah, Dr. Mabuse the Spirit.
Jesus, that was crap. It was just...
I love that movie.
Yeah, no, that's fine. It wasn't for me. It was all...
Well, and here's the thing about Dr. Mabuse de Spieler is that you're not supposed to watch it all in one sitting because...
I didn't. Okay. Trust
really, me. You watched... Did you watch the whole thing in two parts or whatever?
Yeah, whatever parts it came in. Was it two or three? I watched in one.
It was two. Like, and it was like... Part one was released in theaters, and then part two was like a few months later. But
video.
I've heard people watching it in film classes, and they watch the whole thing, and they talk about how punishing it is. I'm like, you're not supposed to watch it in one sitting. Uh-huh. But I love Dr. Mabuse de Spieler. But when you get to M, when there's the testament of Dr. Mabuse, the sequel, it has the detective from M is also the detective in that movie. It's the same actor, same character and everything. So it's kind of funny how
that's a good movie.
Fritz Lang kind of created this little mini universe around it.
Yeah. The one silent film I'd like to see, but I don't think it'll ever surface is the London After Midnight one with Lon Chaney Sr.
Yeah. Yeah. There's that one. That's like kind of, that's the holy grail of lost silent movies.
Yeah.
And then Murnau's Four Devils is another one that is highly sought after that people really are looking for. And, you know, looking at it, it looks like a pretty interesting film. But I'm reading about that lately. And apparently there might be a copy out there somewhere belonging to one of the actress's estates that maybe they don't know exists, but who knows?
Yeah. You know, probably someone's sitting on it just in a garage somewhere, and they don't even know they've got it probably.
Every 6 years, the rumor comes around that somebody's got it or found it, and they're secretly restructuring it and stuff. So,
yeah.
I remember when they found the more complete version of Metropolis.
Yeah.
Because, you know, Metropolis, most of it was missing for a while. But I saw the reconstructed version of it, but the problem is that the more complete version was found on a, like, 16mm stock. So it was very damaged, and they blew it up. So, like, most of the film is from the, you know, better preserved, partially complete version, and then you have this blown up 16mm stock. So you have parts of the movie that look like shit.
Yeah, yeah, they stick out. You can tell basically what's the new parts because of the quality of it.
I've been watching the Masters of Cinema editions of these, and what's great about those is that they have, like, before the movie starts, they have, like, a couple pages of notes about the restoration, so you know exactly what you're looking at. It's pretty interesting.
Turned your back on Arrow now, have you?
Mr. Arrow Shelf.
Mr. Mock Shelf now, are you?
Listen to Mr. Arrow Shelf betray his roots.
Yeah.
I know. Talking to Joachim and Tom, clearly.
Yeah, really.
But
you don't walk around no more with those Arrow titles in your in your pants, no more.
The Arrow release of Resquiat or some spaghetti western. I don't know.
Hey, John, just imagine Hunter going to a club, you know, impressive ladies with these Arrow titles, you know.
He's got the Arrow sweatshirt.
Yeah, really. The chick comes up to him and goes, "Oh, Hunter, is that an Arrow in your pocket? Are you just happy to see me?"
And he says, "Yo, Mr. Arrow Shelf aims to please." he's like the candy tangerine man, yeah. You know, on the make.
Bring happiness over to you, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah.
But the a lot of these silent movies are preserved by the Murnau Foundation, the Sitfung or whatever the German term is, but you'll see his foundation on a lot of these, and they provide like a lot of notes on where the source is for these, so if these shots look like they're of lower quality than the others, here's why, because they're sourced from this, you know, because a lot of these movies are incomplete, the versions we have, so
right. Basically just trying to appease the film snobs by detailing every bit in there that's not up to par with these people.
Well, but here's the thing. When you're watching Metropolis, you're like, why do half the shots in this – not half, but like why do like a fifth of the shots in this movie look like shit?
Yeah, well, that's right. But the thing is, I watched Nosferatu, the 22 version we're going to speak about very shortly, and it's a scratchy, fucked up looking old thing. You know, it was perfectly fine for a film nearly 100 years old.
Sure, but I mean, even all the shots in Nosferatu – look a million times better than some of the shots they cut to in Metropolis.
Oh, no, I understand. Metropolis sticks out like a sore thumb. It's
there are plenty of shots in Metropolis that, you know, have been restored to look beautiful, but there's parts of that movie where it looks like somebody ran over the film stock with a car, you know, and that's explaining why. It's just saying that. And it's kind of cool because the Kino video releases of the same prints don't provide you with any of that information. So it's just interesting to know.
Yeah, I know. I still attest that George Lucas pinched that robot as C-3PO from Metropolis.
Oh, yeah, when you look at the old Macquarie production art, he looked even more like that robot.
Absolutely.
But he ain't going to tell you that.
No.
No, he'll say it's from Kurosawa or something.
Yeah, it's an original concept from watching The Hidden Fortress.
Yeah, really.
I wanted Flash the bickering Gordon. Peasants. The pulling the princess out of enemy territory was a coincidence.
Yeah. All right, so just before we get into Nosferatu, have you seen the version out there scored by Typo Negative?
No, I haven't, but didn't Arrow do that? Wasn't that Arrow Video?
You would know, Mr. Arrow Shelf.
and it wasn't officially scored by Typo Negative because it was Arrow Video. They got it and they put Typo Negative music on it, but according to the Peter Steele biography, it was done without any licensing.
Okay.
So they used Typo Negative music, but they didn't. Typo Negative didn't actually score it or license any of the music, so it was kind of illegal.
Okay, because I have the copy I have on DVD is by Force Video, a company here, who licensed it from Eureka. They're a British company, are they?
Yeah, I believe. Eureka's the company that does Masters of Cinema.
Okay, and I'll be damned. I don't know who did the score on it, but I'll be damned if it's not Typo Negative. It sounds a lot like their... Not their heavy stuff, obviously, with all the guitars. There's no guitars or nothing on here, but it's very avant-garde, industrial-ish sounding.
It sounds like Josh Silver's sitting there on the keyboards.
I don't know who that is, but I'm guessing
it's funny. Keyboard is some Typo Negative.
Right.
My version was the Kino restoration that's actually available on Amazon Prime. You can just watch it for free if you're a member.
Right.
And it's supposedly properly restored to the right tense and everything.
Yeah, the Kino edition is the official Murnau Sitfung.
Is that the one that has like the green sections and the...
Yeah, it's got the orange and the green.
They've got the proper tinting, you know, when they're at Orlok's castle, it's blue.
Right.
When they're inside at the firelight, it's yellow. It's yellow tinted. Like on the Masters of Cinema release, they have a commentary with David Callett, which is very good, and he talks about what specific tense were supposed to mean, because film stock wasn't sensitive enough to shoot at night, you would shoot during the day for night, but you would do blue tinting to make it, and audiences understood that meant night. Yellow typically meant firelight or morning. Red meant dusk or I forget what else, but it was the different tints meant different things.
You okay. Because mine's strictly in sepia, the whole thing.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
And, I have the Masters of Cinema one, and it's the Eureka edition, but it has all the different tints.
No, mine's a set. Like, I bought this, God, it has to be like 15 years ago on DVD at least. Yeah, okay. Many, many years ago. Let me ask you guys, what was the runtime of the one you guys watched?
About an hour and a half, roughly. Like,
that's what I had. Like, it was like 92 minutes or so.
Right, same as, that's the one I've got, about 92 minutes, yeah. All right, because there's many versions out there. Some that run just over an hour.
Yeah, I think Nosferatu was one where shortened versions were only available for a while, and then they found more complete versions because, you know, the film had a lot of legal problems. And
just a couple.
Yeah, just a couple.
And because, fuck you, Mrs. Stoker. We finally got it.
Dracula was not in the public domain at the time. And but what was interesting, though, was David Callett said in the commentary that in the German version of Nosferatu, in the German credits, it says, based on the novel Dracula by Bram Stoker.
Yeah, really? So
he goes, if they were trying to hide that this was – because, you know, they said that they changed Count Dracula to Count Orlok, Jonathan Harker to Hutter, Mina to Lucy or whatever – that it was it would have been to hide that it was an adaptation of Dracula. Well, saying it was based on Dracula by Bram Stoker in the opening credits was a very terrible
thing. They probably thought they were trying to do the right thing, but without getting the license, that was it. It's like, oh, if we just credit it, I'm sure we'll be all right, but no.
Yeah, and the producer of the movie, Albin Grau, was a very eccentric character. He started this company to make Nosferatu, which was called Prana Film, and he wanted to make occult-based movies because he was a lover of the occult, like Aleister Crowley, all that stuff. And he was, you know, kind of a weirdo, but he told this story that he got the idea for the movie because he was working for, you know, some European military thing in World War I, and was de-lousing a village and met a Serbian – or a, was it a Serbian? Some villager who claimed that his father died and then he didn't get a proper burial, and they saw him walking around in the woods, and they, you know, had to stake his body, and he groaned. And the guy offered proof that the Serbian authorities said this, and, you know, it was likely that, you know, Albin Grau made it up to sell tickets.
Yeah.
But, like, there were a lot of stories around the movie, like, that Max Schreck, and Schreck translates to terror in German, but Schreck was actually his name. Max Schreck was in, like, Bertolt Brecht plays. He had a career. He was in other Murnau films. He had a career. But, you know, there were stories that he never showed up on set out of makeup and out of character. And, you know, there were stories that he was a vampire, which, of course, led to the movie Shadow of the Vampire.
Which is a highly – I mean, it's a good film, but highly fictionalized. You can't really buy into too much of that.
Yeah, the thing about the movie is the Grau character, who's played by Udo Kier, who I met and was a hoot, he said that –
Max – hang on. Udo Kier?
Yeah.
Oh, in the show – I'm thinking he's in Nosferatu. The fuck, he's not that fucking old, really?
He plays Albin Grau.
Yeah. Right.
He plays Albin Grau as sort of this intense producer type, but really he was kind of a cult weirdo slash Roger Corbin type. Like, he would tell these wild stories about the movie to sell tickets, but the movie ended up being a flop anyway. But also Malkovich's performance as Murnau, he plays Murnau as the stereotypical German director, you know, like the tyrannical German director, but that was kind of Fritz Lang, Eric von Stroheim. They had that reputation. Murnau really didn't. He was kind of had more of a meek personality. As from what I've heard, from what I've read and what I've seen in documentaries and stuff, he wasn't that type of person that John Malkovich played. So there's, you know, of course, Shadow of the Vampire takes a story from the set that was probably made up by Grau, but it – the depiction of the key players in it is vast departure from reality as well.
Okay. Right.
Have any of y'all seen Shadow of the Vampire? Have you seen Shadow of the Vampire, Stu? I mean, John?
No, I haven't seen it.
It's a pretty good movie.
It's good fun, yeah.
And,
I never got around to it. I mean, you know, Blockbuster Video disappeared, so the idea of going out and just renting anything you felt like watching, you always have to wait for stuff to pop up on Amazon or Netflix now, so.
Yeah.
I caught it in a theater, actually, when it came out, in 98, 99, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was good fun. I enjoyed it.
Defoe's really great in the role.
Yeah, he really is. Yeah.
As Shrek, you know.
He really is.
Got those long fingernails and, you know, when were you born? I do not remember.
it's a good accompanying piece to this. It won't fill in all the gaps you have about Max Schreck or the film itself, the production, but it's a good little piece to go with it.
Just take it as fiction because it's totally fiction. Like Malkovich's Murnau bears little resemblance to
a bit like Oliver Stone's JFK, right? Just treat it as fiction.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. And Platoon.
Mm.
Yeah.
I'd like to hear about it, potheads.
So how's the Blu-ray of this scrub up?
Oh, it's great.
Yeah.
It looks fantastic. I've got the Kino and the Masters of Cinema Blu-ray. And they both use the same transfer, so they both look about the same. But the special features on the Masters of Cinema one are different. They have a tribute from Abel Ferrara.
God.
It was meant for the Eureka DVD, but it wasn't able. It was shot in like 2007 or something, but it's Abel Ferrara talking about its influence on King of New York, and how Christopher Walken was sort of the Count Orlok type figure in that film,
and a good tie in there as well. The character Christopher Walken played in Batman Returns was named
Shrek.
Max Shrek, yeah. Yeah.
He was that was another tribute. Yeah, that's correct. That's a good one. Yeah. And the Masters of Cinema one also has some a couple of commentaries, including the David Callett one, which is very good. And he also did a commentary for Dr. Mabuse Der Spieler, which he did for all 4.5 hours.
Hey, listeners, let's have a little game, okay? It's every time Hannah says Dr. Mabuse Der Spieler from now on, take a shot.
Yeah.
It's about the fifth time he said he really enjoys, you know.
Oh, it's Dr. Mabuse the Gambler. It's just, I don't know. The Spieler translates to the player, and it seems more appropriate for the Mabuse character, the way he manipulates and hypnotizes and has people do his will for him. You know, I like it better than the Gambler.
What? Yeah, like Marky. Wahlberg's The Gambler is god-awful. Yeah, god-awful.
That movie I saw the trailer for and went, well, never watch that.
No, I watched it on a plane heading over to the States.
Oh,
I'm like,
oh, that's right. Yeah, you told me you saw it.
It was horrid. Every damn film I watched on that plane going to and back, just shit. Birdman, The Gambler, Taken 3. I'm like, God, really?
Taken 3, ugh.
It was horrible. But
last movie I saw on a plane was Spider-Man 3. It's hideous.
No,
I saw on a plane was School for Scoundrels.
Oh, wow. That's been a long time.
Yeah, it's been a while.
Yeah, I'll say. What struck me watching this, I watched it upstairs on the theater screen, was I just couldn't believe as I was watching, this film was nearly 100 years old.
Yeah, it is.
Nearly a century old. It's incredible.
And it's funny, when I was listening to the Herzog commentary on the Blu-ray of the remake, it was funny. They the person who was hosting it with Herzog said, "Oh, I think last year was the or a couple years ago was the anniversary of the Stoker novel." And I was like, "Ah, oh, that commentary must have been recorded in the late 90s."
Yeah, it was, because I had the DVD of that Nosferatu, and it's got a commentary on there as well.
Yeah, yeah, it's kind of funny. But now we're coming up on the 100-year anniversary of Nosferatu.
Yeah,
the original.
Yeah. And you know who else watched this film? I thought to myself when I was watching was, you know damn well Rob Zombie's seen this 100 times over.
Well, he puts it in his music videos, and he has that, like, horrible teenage Nosferatu pussy song or whatever.
And God help us, exactly. You know one day he's going to remake Nosferatu, and he's going to give it an origin story, and it's going to be like...
Nosferatu's going to be going after Sherry Moon.
Yeah, Sherry Moon, and we have like Sid Hager's Zippy the Clown or some shit. Has no point being
the
there,
real,
but
the real story is why Orloff became Count Orloff.
Yeah, yeah.
That's about the facet.
It'd be all how he became Count Orloff. Yeah, and a music video by Rob Zombie and Lionel Richie, you know, at the end. It's like, oh, God, no.
Living dead girl.
Oh, yeah, yeah. But, okay, so who had seen this before? Honey, you said you'd seen it before. Johnny, you ever seen this before?
I saw it some years ago. I don't remember if it was Laserdisc or VHS, but I did watch it many, many years. I may have even watched it on Turner Classic Movies, maybe even when TNT was showing classic films before they made Turner Classic Movies. So I had seen it before, but this is my first time in life.
Have you seen the Herzog one before, though?
I had never seen the Herzog version. I think I used to see bits and pieces of it on HBO, because what they would do in 1981, whenever they were airing the film, they would air the English version in daylight or daytime, and they'd run the subtitle version at night.
For the Insomniacs, right.
Because there's a he did a version in English and a version in German.
I watched
the English version.
Yeah, I watched the English one. I've seen both. They're both shot subsequently together at the same time. But Herzog said, I think in the commentary, that he feels that the German one's more natural.
And you get Kinski's voice too.
Kinski's in the English version.
Yeah.
Well, there were some scenes where in the commentary where he was saying that this version, there's this scene where Kinski's talking quietly to the Lucy character, and he said, I feel this scene is stronger in the German version because you're getting Kinski's voice. That's what he said.
Right.
Maybe he's talking his voice in German, so is my guess.
Yeah, because it'd be his native tongue.
Yeah, in the German version, and which made me think, okay, well, maybe the English version is dubbed or something. I don't know.
No, it's the actor's voice because the English is terrible.
Even,
well, because the first time I saw the Herzog version, I saw it in English. Mm. And I remember thinking that it was strong visually, but I wasn't really connecting with the performances. And then when I saw the German version, I was a lot more into it. Like, I was more absorbed into the film.
That's because it had subtitles and it was more foreign.
Yeah, no, exactly. No, you're right, and it's. I don't speak the language, but you kind of. I think you can pick up on emotions a little more.
Hey, it felt more Arrow-ish watching
him. Yeah, right. It's more word
right.
Arrow. No,
you know, I was sitting
more
there. My glasses. The Arrow logo popped up in my glasses.
It's not the only thing that popped up exactly.
Yeah,
along with my wood, you know, but
Mr. Arrow shelf.
That's what Hunter classes of foreplay is the Arrow logo.
Came on the show from now on, Mr. Arrow Show.
But I saw bits and pieces of it, and I remember seeing clips on Siskel and Ebert when I think they were doing the sneak preview show on PBS, and they showed clips and gave it thumbs up and everything. Oh. It was really a movie for critics. When it opened in Jackson, Mississippi, it played at the Art House Theater that also doubled as a porn house. So
of course it did.
You're right, and it's just like that's the only place that stuff played because it was near Millsaps College, I believe.
No wonder Johnny Cash was going back to Jackson.
Yeah.
And I was thinking about how, Herzog said that he felt that Nosferatu was the greatest German film of all time.
I would disagree. There's like six really good Commissar X movies. And four really good Jerry Cotton movies, so I totally disagree.
he said he like his generation of filmmakers that he said we were a generation of orphans because our fathers took part in the Nazism and we didn't have fathers, so we had to look to our grandfathers and he said we had to look to Murnau and Lang and Pabst and Wegener and all these other people. So he said that that Murnau was this influence, and I was thinking about it, and I was like, Murnau did make Taboo, which was a film where he went out to the Polynesia to make a docudrama, and Nosferatu was a film that used a lot of location work. And
it didn't have a lot of built sets, which was the norm for silent movies, especially German silent movies. And I was thinking about how, the opening of Herzog's movie, the opening credits, you have all those mummies.
Oh, yeah, they're real as well.
Yeah, they're from Guanajuato, Mexico.
Mm.
And Herzog said...
They needed Lucha Libre masks on, really, to identify where they're from.
Those are some... That opening is really... I think it's great atmosphere. Those mummies sitting there. And you notice the early shots, it's all like babies. And then the corpses get older and older as the shots go on. Yeah. But he said that those were in a museum he saw there when he was living in Mexico. And he went back there and they were able to take them out and put them in and prop them up. But they were all corpses from a cholera epidemic. And, and that was one thing that in Nosferatu, that it was kind of invoking the flu epidemic. And like, there's this sort of feeling of plague coming with the ship with coming to town with with the vampire on it in both movies.
Mm-hmm.
And it was kind of, I thought that was kind of interesting that he opened up the movie with these actual corpses from a actual outbreak of disease in an area.
One thing I did find about going back to the 22 version, seems we seem to be crisscrossing, but whatever, they're both pretty much the same film.
Oh, yeah, we're just kind of going back and forth.
Yeah,
The only major difference really between them is the vampire character. Max Schreck's character is, as Herzog described, more of an insect. He's a
rat-like.
He's the plague. You know?
Yeah.
And he's fixated on Harker in the Herzog version, his wife. And but in the Herzog version, he's more of the sort of the lonely vampire who's kind of lost his identity in time and sort of longs for love and all that stuff, but at the same time is overcome by his need for to feed and to, you know, be this creature of the night. He is more of a human dimension to him in the Herzog version, whereas he's more of a monster in the Murnau film.
More in the Herzog one, the Count Orlok character is certainly more intense, being Kinski, of course.
He's also Dracula. He's Count Dracula in the Herzog version.
He's called Count Dracula.
Because they used all the names because they were public domain, so they could finally call them Jonathan Harker.
I'm saying like Count Orlok because I just think of Count Orlok. Yeah. But you get what I'm saying? One thing I did take away from watching both versions back to back was that the female character, the female lead, Isabella Gianni, is a damn sight more better looking than fucking transsexual he got in the Nosferatu original. Oh, that's horrible. It looks like a cross dresser. It really does. It's like she's very unappealing. I'd rather look at Isabella Gianni any day.
And Herzog was saying the girl who played Lucy was really insecure on the set. He said she was very difficult to direct, but it kind of came out in her face.
Right.
That he was able to kind of use that to make her seem like this vulnerable character. And I thought I had read that Kinski wasn't such a – because Kinski, you know, has a reputation for being Satan on the movie set.
No, the hell you say.
Yeah, the hell you say.
Did you guys ever see the documentary My Best Fiend?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I watched it again last night, actually.
Years ago.
Yeah, that's a great one.
It is.
But he said that Herzog said that Kinski wanted his Orlok to be a little more louder and energetic, a showier performance. And so Herzog said that, you know, he would let Kinski, you know, yell and scream and blah, 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 kind of expend his energy and then, you know, shoot him. And most of the scenes were done in only a couple takes. It was a very low budget film. And he said that
this is Herzog's story, that it was, getting Kinski to get that energy out sort of made it easier to have him be the sort of quiet, more subdued Count Dracula. And
well, you don't want to make it all ham-fisted. Or Richard Stanley says, ham-fisted, like the Coppola one. The Coppola one just...
Oh, and if you listen to the Herzog commentary, he spends a lot of time talking about what doesn't work about the Coppola film.
Oh, it's I watched it again.
The Coppola swiped a lot from both versions, I thought.
It does, and he said he felt that the Coppola movie, he said he felt the first... like 5 or 10 minutes of the Coppola movie, he was really good. And then he said, because he loves the otherworldly aspects. Like he said, the vampire movie needs the shadows, it needs the otherworldly parts.
Yeah.
He said it needs the sort of unexplained supernatural bits. And he said that the Coppola film has that in the first few minutes, and then it just gets away from that and never comes back to it in the rest of the film.
No.
And he said that was his problem with that film. And, you know, there are things I like about the Coppola movie and things I dislike about it. It's one of these flawed, deeply flawed movies.
Yeah, very flawed.
There are things I like about it, but it's, it has a lot of issues. But, you know, I love a lot of the visual look of it, but it has a lot of terrible acting, like really
horrible acting.
Like, yeah. Especially from Keanu Reeves, who is very miscast, in the movie.
I think a couple of more. I mean, Anthony Hopkins was miscast, so I didn't like him in that.
Hopkins was terrible.
Yeah.
Way over the top. Gary Oldman was fun in his role, but, Keanu Reeves, who apparently, if you ask him, he'll be like, oh, it's one of my worst performances. But he's like, I've nailed the bastard at Carfax Abbey.
Yeah.
Like British Ted Theodore Logan,
Yeah, really. One of the best Keanu Reeves films I've said for the longest time was that Shoot In Tomorrow. It was a lot of fun to watch.
I love John Wick. It's my...
Oh, God, no. That was shitful.
No, John Wick is great. John, back me up on this.
Yeah, I enjoyed John Wick.
Of course you did.
Not the greatest, not just solid. That's all I can say.
Our friend Garrow really liked John Wick as well.
He enjoyed it.
Yeah. I like John Wick. I saw it in IMAX.
But you know who hated it was Johnny Regasca.
Oh, really? Okay, well, I bet the only two who didn't like it.
He posted a negative review of it, and he thought it was just too much stuff he'd already seen before.
Right.
But he also didn't like the Raid. He didn't like the Raid 2 either, so
hang on. I can sort of see his point. The Raid 2 is good, but it's way too long. It's about 45 minutes too long. Yeah.
I agree about it being too long. I think it is a dope action movie, though.
Oh, it is. I mean, it really is. But it's a good, like John said, 30 to 45 minutes. But probably 30 to 40 minutes too long. It's just some bits just go on and on and on. But anyway, with Nosferatu, what did you come away thinking in the end? Which one did you prefer more?
Silent.
Well, John, what do you say?
Silent version.
Yeah.
I must say straight out, I didn't like the Herzog version that much.
What didn't you like about it?
I think it's because, first of all, it was all stagey looking. Very, very, and it's, I don't know if it's true of the German version, but the English version, incredibly stagey acting, like you're watching a play. I didn't think Kinski seemed threatening as in his Dracula / Orlov performance. It's just, I don't know, he just looks like a little weasel. I like some things about it, like the way the town is dying off and stuff because of the rats, and there's nobody to arrest Van Helsing at the end.
Oh.
But a lot of it was like watching one of those Jess Franco Jack the Ripper or one of his...
Exactly.
Indiana just doesn't move, as static shots. And it's a type of horror film that appeals to critics because I think critics like, just because it said directed by Herzog, because they were so on his dick at the time and they'd praise anything he did, and that existed back then. And it's just like, it's like horror, art house horror for people who really don't watch horror films.
What I'll say, though, is I saw the English version a while back, and it's been a while since I've seen it, but I didn't think much of it. I saw Gere, I saw Fitzcarraldo. I thought those were great movies, and I just kind of saw Nosferatu as this sort of remake Herzog did that wasn't that great. But when I saw the German version, I liked it quite a bit more.
It doesn't add that much difference, really, German or English. It's not a great deal.
I don't know. For some reason, I love the – I don't think it's stagey at all. There's a lot of handheld camera work. There's a lot of location work.
I'm talking about the actors' performances. Like, there's a scene where Kinski is literally walking – like the scene where he first encounters the Isabella Gianni character, and she's like looking in the mirror and sees him and
his shadow
shown or whatever. Yeah, or and his shadow comes around and she's like the way she's delivering her lines and moving, it's like they're trying to move like the silent film characters. They're not moving naturally like human beings actually move. You know, they're moving like that sputtered still frame look that's in silent film, you know. Really weird. And they're delivering lines that are poetry instead of dialogue. You know, God will not end my love. You know, it was just like this kind of rambling prose instead of dialogue that they're speaking to each other. I just felt that it's very, you know, for a film made in 1979, that's just not really acceptable. It's very, that's like shooting something silent and being pretentious and black and white.
Really, it could have been silent. It really could have been stolen with cards.
Well, and that scene had a very silent quality. Like it had the shadow in the mirror and the door closing and the shadow staying there. You know, it's a very expressionistic shot.
Right. And what I liked about the old silent film is like he's a monster in the silent film. There's nothing romantic about it at all. I like the idea of a monster vampire. Like he comes on the screen, it's very visually aggressive horror. Just seeing him on screen, he's literally still to this day the most frightening vampire ever seen on film.
There are people who
have never seen Nosferatu that tell me they have had nightmares about a bald vampire with Spock ears because they saw a clip of Nosferatu on the Radio Gaga video when they were little, or saw a picture in a film book, and they have nightmares about that image of the vampire, and that's. That makes him, to me, the scariest-looking vampire in film history.
And let's talk about the Murnau version for a second. I think the Murnau version, one of the reasons I love it so much is that it's not one of those movies where you're like, ooh, I'm so scared while you're watching it, but it disturbs you. It sort of stays with you.
Oh, it creeps you the hell out. It creeped me out. Big time.
There's this shot where Hutter is in his bedroom, and he looks out the door, and down the corridor you see the vampire like in the shadow down the hallway, and that scene is like, that is the stuff nightmares are made of, like that little shot, and it just sticks with you, and that the way Shrek stands with his hands like as these little claws, like you know the way he stands with his arms really stiff, and his hands sort of splayed out. It's almost like a scorpion readying its tail. It just it feels like this creature that's coming to feed, you know. And it that bit where Hutter is at the castle, and I think it works well in the Herzog version as well. That the parts where he's at and Bruno Ganz who plays him in the Herzog version, who many will know as Hitler in that viral video where Hitler yells about stuff. He plays Jonathan Harker in that version. But the stuff with him there, but especially in the Murnau version where he's looking down the hall and when he comes into the bedroom, it's absolutely like, I think it's some of the scariest stuff that's ever been put on film. Not because it terrifies you while you're watching it, but because it stays with you. It's a very disturbing film.
It is.
On a very subconscious level.
And that says a lot about the film being nearly 100 years old. It could still do that after all that time.
It's like, it's also more faithful to the Stoker novel than the Bela Lugosi version.
It's completely ass about. Yeah, you know, because in the Dracula, the Todd Browning one, Renfield gets sent to Transylvania to sign up. Whereas in this one, Renfield's actually the real estate agent or the merchant, whatever, sending Harker, which is why it is in the book as well.
His name is Nock in the Murnau film.
But the Renfield character basically it is.
Yeah.
And that's where what's his name? Fatso. Coppola's Dracula is faithful as well. He sends Harker.
Tom Hanks. I mean, Tom Waits.
Yeah,
Tom Waits. Honestly, the best thing about that film. Best thing about.
Yeah, Master is here.
Yeah.
He's like chewing on flies. And but I will say, though, in the Todd Browning one, I do love Dwight Fry as when Renfield, when he goes crazy.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, he's great. He's terrific.
Great, great influence on Alice Cooper as well.
Oh, very much so. Wrote a song about him. Like to hear it. Here it goes. Yeah. It's an old Lillian B. Collard joke there.
What's funny is when you listen to the Kallett commentary, he talked about like the guy who played the Renfield character, Nock, in the original.
Mm.
He went on to, you know, do a lot of films in Hollywood with German expats like Fritz Lang. And the guy who played Hutter was a massive communist. And he fled to the Soviet Union and ended up in East Berlin directing theater, I think.
Oh, wow.
East Berlin. Yeah. Weird. The guy. Yeah. So it's kind of funny. Like when you listen to that commentary, he tells you what happened to like so many people involved in the movie and cast members. Like some of them died, were Jews who were killed in the Holocaust.
Mm-hmm.
And it's pretty crazy. Like Shrek actually died not too long after that. But he had a career with Murnau and in theater and stuff. Like he wasn't this sort of weirdo that the legends has that you get from Shadow of the Vampire, but it's pretty interesting. That's a commentary. Like if you have an all region Blu-ray player, that's a great commentary to listen to.
No, it's not a case. If you have an all region, it's like, get one really.
Yeah, no,
in this day and age, you should have one.
You need one. It's essential.
It is. I especially the Masters of Cinema, like those, their silent releases blow the Kino ones out of the water. I will say.
Okay.
The Kino, the one thing about the Kino Nosferatu Blu-ray is that it has an English language title cards one, but you know, who cares?
Okay, so myself, I prefer the original, the silent, easily.
Yeah.
I'm in the same boat as John. I think the remake, I can pretty much take it or leave it. It's not, doesn't do much for me. The Rats and the remake fucked me over big time. Because I have a massive aversion to rats and
there's a lot mice. More of them in there.
There is a shit ton.
Yeah. And
definitely more animal wranglers.
Yeah. And they died. Those were white rats that they died
gray.
That's why a lot of chewing them on themselves.
Yeah, trying to get the powder off their coat. Yeah.
Herzog was saying they had to like seal off the town and they even fixed all the rats they couldn't reproduce because they were releasing so many of them. And Murnau wanted to release around that number, but he wasn't allowed to in his day. And doing so would have been just crazy. But, I don't think in Herzog's version it added a whole lot to have that massive number of rats, but the...
No,
he's not a visually dynamic director. That's completely
weird.
Like, he depends too much on natural look, and it just doesn't work. It wouldn't have mattered anyway.
Honestly, I felt that the remake was overlit. It was way too.
Yeah,
fucking,
it was.
I didn't like it. I didn't like the way it was shot at all. I thought it was awful. You know, it was.
I like the remake quite a bit more than y'all do.
Yeah,
but there are things I like. Like I like a lot of location work. I like the, you know, he uses like real gypsies in Slovakia or whatever to greet him and stuff. So you get the stereotypical, like, I'm going to Castle Dracula.
I'll tell you one thing that bugged me in that remake, and it's going to sound really petty and stupid, but when Harker goes to, he's on the way to Castle Dracula in Transylvania, and he's sitting at that inn or that diner, whatever he's eating. And he goes, oh, hurry up, I need to go to the castle. And the innkeeper goes, which one? He goes, Castle Dracula, whatever it was. And the woman drops the plate, and the way she drops the plate looks so acted. It's not natural.
Yeah. Well, they were all gypsies. Like, none of those people were actors. Like,
really, I can't tell.
Yeah, which makes sense, you know.
Yeah, it was, and plus it was like Stuart pointed out with the photography, it's overlit to, like, duplicate the look of natural light, which I think really backfired. Just makes it look very drab.
Yeah. That's the sort of film, really, if you had the function on your computer, your television or projector, whatever, to make it black and white, it may help it a bit. It was just too colorful for a Dracula film. And that was one of the three Dracula films apparently out in that year in 79. There was the Frank Langella one. Was it Frank Langella was in that?
Yeah, it was Frank Langella.
Yeah, which is okay. I'm not that big on it. But my favorite of the three is actually the Love at First Bite, which I still love to this day. It's great. And it was the most popular of the three, but...
It was a huge,
massive hit. But apparently these days now, the bigger of the cult hits of the three is the Herzog one, which I really can't work out. Because, like I said, it's okay. I can...
The Herzog one's the one that's had kind of legs, but it hasn't had the life that the original has had, for sure. But
no.
No, it's not like by horror fans. It's like by Herzog fans.
Because I'm a Herzog fan. I love Herzog.
Oh, me too.
I think he's an extremely interesting person. Like, I think he's one of these filmmakers who I think is a man of the world, you know, just has interesting stories. You know, I just think he's a really interesting person, and it comes through his films. You know, I think this movie, I think his remake is better than y'all do. I don't think it's one of his greatest films, but I think it, as far as a genre vampire movie, I think it's quite good.
It's no Aguirre.
Aguirre, and it's not Fitzcarraldo. Those are massive films.
No, even Cobra Verde is one of my... I really like that a lot of his. Yeah.
The only movie he did with Kinski that I really don't like is Wojciech.
Yeah, Wojciech's... It's like a Woody Allen drama.
Play. It's just...
Although it's tougher to dig Kinski these days with the accusations from Paula Kinski and stuff, so I'm like, you know. You're watching a real creep.
What was the accusations?
Paula Kinski said that he pretty much molested her for years.
Oh, jeez.
And Natasha Kinski kind of backed it up and said, yeah.
Well, and Natasha Kinski is, you know, her sexual problems are very well documented. She had an affair with Polanski on the set of Tess, and this was after he was run out of the U.S. He was having an affair with Natasha Kinski on Tess, and she was underage then.
Yeah.
And, and apparently she had an affair with Paul Schrader on Cat People. And according to John Milius, she said to Paul Schrader, "Paul, I always fuck my directors, but with you, it was too difficult."
Boy, there's a kick up the ass, I tell you, right there.
Yes, it's like you're too involved. Like, you know, normally it's just we have sex and the movie's over and that's it.
Mm. But personally, I prefer the original myself. What about yourself, Hunter?
Oh, I totally prefer the original. I think the original for me is a 10 out of 10. Like, it's one of my favorite movies because I watch it quite frequently, and whenever I watch it, it doesn't get old. I watch it with any commentary, with anything, you know, different title cards, whatever.
Yeah.
You know, the Herzog movie is it's a fun way to watch it. But, you know, John was saying he doesn't like the romantic angle, and I'm with him. Like, I prefer I don't like romantic vampires. Even though he's still ugly, he still looks like the Shrek character. I don't like sexy vampires. I like ugly, disgusting vampires. I like the plague rat vampire of Shrek.
You don't like the Frank Langella's of his day or the Twilight shit, whatever.
I don't like Twiglet vampires. I don't like the Coppola film. I think has interesting things in it, and it goes in a bunch of different directions, but.
Well, you like Gary Oldman look like a member of the Grateful Dead? No.
It kind of goes too far in that direction with the romance.
The worst thing about it is it pushes Oldman's Dracula as a like Vlad Tepes, which that's not Dracula.
Yes.
Vlad Tepes was not an inspiration on Dracula. Bram Stoker had probably never heard of Vlad Tepes when he wrote Dracula. One has nothing to do with the other, but people have stuck with that myth. Ever since the Dan Curtis Dracula telemovie tied them together,
I know Christopher Lee bought into that whole Vlad being a Dracula thing.
That became the thing because there was this quack book called In Search of Dracula that tried to say, "Oh, it was really Vlad Tepes, who was sometimes known as Dracula or whatever."
And Vlad the Impaler,
Let's
Please. Let's be real. Vlad Tepes really kept out the invading Turks at the time. Yeah. Like, you know, he's known as this monster, but really he did, probably he did a good job protecting his... He protected his people from a very pervasive invading force at the time.
Yeah, he was a hero. He, like, that's what you did. You killed them. It's like you impaled them. I mean, you didn't put daisies
in
there.
And the idea of the impalings was to scare them off, and it did that.
Yeah.
A bit like the Donald Trump of his day, I guess, you know, with the whole immigration thing, really.
Right, right. You know, he would have these forests of impaled soldiers, and people would go, well, this guy's not fucking around, and they'd leave.
Yeah, you make a point. You don't have television. You don't have a telephone.
You're going to make a point, I'm going to stick up your ass.
Yeah, it's just like, hey,
I did a presentation on Vlad Tepes my senior year of high school, and as part of my presentation, I had sausages on a stick.
Okay.
Sausages on a stick. That was part of my presentation.
But now that's stuck. I've argued with a currently very successful TV writer and producer about whether or not Stoker was inspired by the Vlad Tepes story. He was absolutely convinced. And they provided these links that just didn't prove anything. And it's like, there's no connection. It's just, it was made by people who don't understand correlation is not causation.
Right.
They don't understand the difference.
You know what's interesting
as
well?
And nowhere in the book is it say... that Dracula's Vlad Tepes, because I've read the book twice when I was a kid. It's not even in there. It's never even implied.
The Dracula character in Stoker's book is a very Victorian character. Like,
there has been conjecture for years that Stoker didn't even write the book.
Yeah, that's true. There is.
I heard it was his gay lover who was the writer of it.
And Stoker was very likely a homosexual.
He was very well known.
Oscar Wilde both pursued the same frigid woman to have their children.
Who's gonna get her? You are. Yeah,
the you know, it's the gay man who wants the frigid woman to have their kids. You know,
right? Exactly. So it's like, I'd like to see more of that mythology with the gay lover supposedly writing it and everything.
There's a good little doco out there about 45 minutes on Bram Stoker, which delves heavily into that whole. You know, did he write Dracula? I think basically it's about the majority of the documentary.
I think I smell a future Roland Emmerich movie, you guys.
Yeah, well.
Anonymous? Anybody?
But they'll remove the homosexuality, so there you go.
There you go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's right, because even though it's Roland Emmerich, you know,
he can't face himself. He can't stand
the... What's that movie about transsexuals he did that he has the straight white guy throwing the first brick or something? He's like, what?
The Patriot?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, The Patriot. That's it.
There you go.
Stonewall or something like that. He made some
well played, Stu. Well played.
He made some sort of gay, some gay thing that is now under controversy.
Yeah, it's pretty funny, but I don't know. You get what you deserve.
Speaking of Mel, I picked up The Passion of the Christ on Blu-ray finally.
Good.
Last week, I watched a bit of it upstairs. Oh God, it's gonna be tough to get through that. Not that it's bad. It's just
Mel Gibson's one of my favorite directors. So
yeah.
But, I love Apocalypto, The Passion of the Christ, Braveheart. It's all good stuff.
I've not seen
Lucio Fulci's Christ. I remember.
Yeah.
Jeez.
I especially like the Goblin score. Or was it Fabio Frizzi? I can't remember.
Well, let's go around the table here and let's give our ratings for the original first. Hunter?
For the original, I give it a 10.
All right, John?
It's an 8.
Okay, yeah, for me, I think it's about a 9. I really, really liked it a lot. It breezed through quite quicker than the Herzog one.
It's over before it. When I watch it, it's over so quickly. I'm like, oh, what?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's one sign that's a great movie for me.
I've got to work out who the hell did that score on that DVD. I've got to find out because it's scary as all shit.
I,
I got to look at mine because I've got some, the editions I have. I need to look and see who did the different scores because, you know, they're pretty good.
All right. Okay, the Herzog remake.
I like the score in the Herzog too. For me, the Herzog remake is about an 8. I really like it.
Okay. John?
I give it a 3.
Oh, wow. Whoa. Okay, that's, tough.
Sorry, I found it tedious. It's like I said, it's like some Jess Franco movie I rented or something. And
yeah. Yeah.
I will say, John, I've seen Jess Franco movies and bored shitless by them in a way I don't feel by this movie. Maybe it's because of my fandom of the original.
Yeah.
Really, really helps. But, you know, I've never been able to make it through a Jess Franco film.
He's Jack the Ripper was all right.
Well, you got to remember, I've been watching these for so long that I've now got to quite a few of them. I won't tolerate anymore. It's like, I don't have time for this nonsense.
I've tried Jess Franco films, never been able to watch one.
Oh, they're awful. The only good one is, like, Attack of the Robots and with Eddie Constantine playing Glennie Caution. There might be, like, two or three others that are decent from the 60s, and, you know, after that, you can forget it.
Yeah.
Right. Okay.
But you're chasing a fetish. Put it this way. He's a fetish. He's not a film appreciation. He's a fetish.
Well, the thing I've kind of picked up from his fans is that it's sort of a weird obsession they have.
Well, like Vincent Gallo, I asked him about. I had heard you and Donnie Ramone compete with each other who has more like movies on videotape. And then Vincent Gallo's like, I can't beat Johnny at that. He loves these terrible Jess Franco movies, and they're just horrible. They're terrible. And he said, like, you know, Johnny Ramone was just nuts over Jess Franco. He was just collecting everything. And you know,
by the way, should I beat Ice-T in a rap battle back in New York?
And, yeah, but it's like the Jess Franco became the big fetish of the film collectors. So, yeah, the Herzog movie reminded me of that. And maybe even Franco was trying to make something like that. So I was like, 3.
All right. I will give it a 5. A 5. Yeah, it was just there. Yeah. Not bad, not great either. By a long shot. Isabella Gianni was very, very easy to look at, let's say that much.
Yes, she is.
Very much.
Compared those big to eyes. I love like Cheap Trick. I love those big eyes.
what about the big eyes on the transsexual in the original? Jesus Christ.
Yeah, she's a transsexual with the big eyes.
Transsexual.
Yeah, she's got the big eyes.
She's got the big eyes, you know.
So Dyson. One of those trans testicles. You want those?
And if you know, if you look hard enough, you could see Bush. You could see it.
Yeah, someone's been listening to One Night with Dice, I guess.
I've been listening to The Day the Laughter Died.
Oh God, that's right. That's what it's from the two distinct two tape, whatever it was.
Yeah, it's on YouTube, and it's like the metallic KO of standard comedy records. It's just, you know, Dice in front of an audience that's not into him.
No.
It was an unannounced appearance at Dangerfield.
But was it really?
It's really weird to listen to.
It is.
The audience, and his routines are not going over because he doesn't have that audience of chanting bullies, like, cheering on all of his stuff. It's really strange. And it was his idea.
Yeah.
And apparently very well. And it's, you know, it's fascinating. It actually holds up, I think, better than a lot of comedy albums from that era.
Is that the one he talks about when he talks about going to the, like, go to the milk bar, take out the milk, pour out the cheap milk, and he's talking about saving money by pouring the cheaper milk into the expensive, or expensive into the cheap milk cartons, and
probably it sounds like a kind of disconnected
routine. And no one's getting it. No one. It's just silence. It's like, oh Jesus.
Yeah, because they're just not into him. His audience is just not. He doesn't have that bully section just cheering him on. It's not there. And it's weird. I mean, he starts off with this joke. It's like, so my nephew, he's telling me about his first kiss with this girl he likes at school.
Yeah.
And I remember my first kiss. It was some colored hooker on 42nd Avenue.
Yeah.
I go back 3 times a week. And then he's kind of got the audience there. And it's like, you know, he's using these outdated terms because he's basically playing a 50s thug. And then he just starts going into these routines that just make no sense. And they get more disgusting. And the audience really, maybe a third of the crowd is laughing. It's really bizarre.
It's very, very, you know, small spurts of, you know, the odd laughter here and there. It's and people get up and leave as well.
That I've got a, Yeah, people are leaving, and it's like, that's why I said,
where are you going? Oh. Come back. Where are you going?
Metallic KO is this live Stooges album. This is basically Iggy yelling at bikers. Going, I'll pull my cock out. Oh, yeah, throw ice. Ha ha. You know, it's like fighting with bikers. That's it. And they'll start songs. The Stooges will start songs, and then they'll stop them. And then, you know, it's just like they tend to just go on and on, and then somebody will throw something at Iggy, and it stops. It's like this disastrous live show.
Really?
And that's kind of what it reminded me of, listening to the Daily Laughter Die.
I heard the Daily Laughter Die.
It is weirdly brilliant. It's strange.
I haven't heard it for fucking... It's got to be like 15, 20 years. It's been a long-ass time. 15 years, I'd say. Yeah. I heard part two when it came out. Actually, Rob had picked it up, and we listened to it all from start to finish, and we just looked at you and go, this is shit. Yeah, it's so bad.
It's like, I haven't heard part two. I've only heard half of part one, and I got to listen to the rest of it. But it was pretty fascinating, because I think when people quote Dice, more of the quotes actually come from this than his old routines, which were, you know,
they just quote the Little Miss Tuff that sat on a Mullis Muff or whatever the thing is.
The dirty nursery rhymes. And then by the time he did one of those, a later album, he was so sick of doing the dirty nursery rhymes because people were yelling for them. And then he would just go, he was so sick of doing them. He just goes, Jack and Jill went up the hill and fucked him in the ass. And then he just goes, lift this puppet, shut us up and fucked him in the ass. So the crowd's going crazy. But he just obviously was just sick of doing them.
Yeah.
You know, it's just like they get tired of that routine. Jay Moore had told this story about how Dice was trying to do this whole routine about being a dad and taking his kids to the park. He was trying to get out of that character, and the audience just wasn't going for it. And they're just going, do the nursery rhymes! And then he's like, but kids that go into the park, there's the monkey bars, and they're not paying attention. I'm like, what about the bikes? Because he brought bikes for them to ride. And then the audience is like, do the nursery rhymes! And Dice just knows he can't get out of that character. He can't escape it. So he just says somebody else, you big teddy and the mole, and then starts going into his old routines, and everybody goes crazy. It's like they won't let him do anything different. It's like he had to become the Dice Man. You know,
be an interesting show to do about just Dice Clay and not.
Well, I thought about doing Dice Rules, the concert film.
Oh God!
When he did his peak, poor Trailing gets pulled out of theaters. They put out the Dice Rules concert film, and they're scared to release it. Because there was all these like threats and everything about release, so they released it with the no one under 17 admitted, and it was released in theaters on the bad side of town. You know, they were like really scared to. Because I remember the controversies when it came out, and Leonard Maltin of all people gave it a good review. And
is that the one?
He says some things that are really bad, but he's very funny. You know,
so, is that one of the one? Is it the one from Madison Square Garden, or is that the other one?
Yeah, it was the Madison Square Garden one. He has like a full backup band and comes out and does a song called Brooklyn Bad Boy.
Right, I remember it.
And all it is Elvis's Elvis's Burning Love with new lyrics about basically the fake Dice biography.
Yeah.
And he does a whole intro saying, you know, how he came up and how the Dice Man came to be. And he's got the cross-eyed friend sitting next to him named Noodles, who just like goes, yeah, you know, it's complete Goomba, Guido stereotypes galore, and pretty much the last big thing he did, and then he's doing an Albert Pune movie 2 years later.
Oh, he was out here last year.
He said he's huge in Australia. He says Australians love him.
Well, yeah, probably the 10 people in the pub who went and saw him probably did, but that's about it, because he was playing like little shacks.
Oh, really? He was like, oh, no, they love me in Australia.
Yeah, they probably do, but I mean, the places he was playing held basically nobody. They were just...
Yeah, he doesn't play big venues anymore. That's a thing in the past.
And I'm sorry, $85 to come see Dice? Fuck that. That's too much. That's ridiculous.
I know. It's bad enough. It's like $30 to see comedians here.
Yeah. All right. Well, I think we'll wrap it up for this week. We're just about done.
Yeah.
So what we got planned next week, we'll sort out, and you guys don't have to worry about it. We'll work it out.
Something Halloween-y.
Halloween-y, yeah.
I think we're still in the Halloween stuff.
We're still in October, so we'll work out something, of course.
Guys, let's do Friday the 13th.
Yeah, dude.
Hey,
yeah.
Hey, let's do the third one where Jason gets his hockey mask.
Yeah.
Halloween 3. Nobody likes that one.
Oh, I do. You're wrong, dude. I love Halloween 3.
Let's play the Halloween, the Silver Shamrock song.
Over and over again. throughout the whole show.
Just like we'll be talking and in the background, it'll be like.
Halloween. It's time, kids. Don't forget your masks.
We should go live at 9 o'clock and say, all right, kids, you got your masks on. It's 9 o'clock with the Midnight Movie Cowboys. And just see, like you said, Hunter, just have that dump, 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 dump in the background. Just, I should actually, you know what? Actually, I can actually grab that bit because I've got it on the soundtrack and just loop it. I can loop it all the way through the fucking show in editing.
It's such a
Stop it! Stop it! Stop it!
There is nothing more tiresome than that movie getting this big retro appreciation. Because I've been hearing it for years.
I've always liked it.
I never cared for it, but I remember when it came out in flop. So it's like that's all I have for it.
Yeah. Well, as we all know, they flopped because they put that Halloween 3. As everyone's always said, if it had been just called Season of the Witch, it would have been a much more popular film, or much more made more money at the theaters, I should say.
It was like a mega dud. But I also think the horror thing was starting to die out at the time. There had been the horror boom since 79, and that was already starting to taper off a bit.
Yeah. All right. Well, we'll work something out, guys, and we're back with something more horror-based next week.
See you on Halloween, kids.
Yeah. All right. Say goodnight, guys.
Adios.
Mahalo.
Thank you for listening to the Midnight Movie Cowboys podcast. To leave feedback and show suggestions, email us at midnightmoviecowboys@gmail.com. Like our Midnight Movie Cowboys show page on Facebook. Follow us on Twitter at MM Cowboys. Subscribe to our podcast on iTunes and feel free to leave us a review. Listen to us on Stitcher.com or the Stitcher Radio app. Want to help the show out? Visit MidnightMovieCowboys.com and hit the PayPal donate link. We appreciate all donations of any denomination. Want to friend us personally on Facebook or follow us on Twitter? Our personal links are on the right side of our homepage. See y'all next time.
Yeah.